And of course, the final hour now of the Skeptics Cage with Dr. Michael Shermer and Dean Radin joins us in a moment. We're going to talk about psychic phenomena right here on Coast to Coast AM. You know, in addition to what we're going to talk about with Dean Radin this hour and Dr. Michael Shermer, Dean has got some experience in knowing about the Global Consciousness Project. You've heard it as the AIG Project, specifically when 9/11 occurred. But these are remote devices that have been dubbed, of course, the Princeton AIGs. And they seem to have an incredible amount of data. We'll talk about that as well. Let us bring in now Dean Radin. Hi, Dean. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm doing quite.
Good. My pleasure. Good. Dr. Michael Shermer, you're on the other end there still, Michael? Still holding on?
I'm still awake.
Okay, great. This is your final hour, Michael, so hold on.
Okay, wait, I got my coaches training me here.
You got it. Dean, the psychic phenomena, I'd like you to open up this hour with your thoughts in your direction on this.
Okay, my background is, if there was a twist of fate, I would have ended up being more like Michael. I think,
really?
than either Russell or Gary Schwartz. When you go through graduate school and get a PhD in experimental psychology, by the end of that, you become extremely skeptical about the possibility that psychic phenomena might be real. And when I finished my PhD, I was interested in the same way that many people are at least interested in these phenomena, but I didn't really believe it. And I didn't believe it for the same reason that Michael doesn't, that unless you can see the miracle firsthand, again and again and again, you really don't have much reason to believe it. And so the dozen or so skeptical mantras are much easier to fall back on. And I'm talking about things like, well, it's not repeatable, or it's very weak, or people have been studying it for a long time and no one seems to have accepted it. So that's where I was. And the twist of fate was that when I was working at Bell Laboratories, I had read about the possibility that mind and matter could interact. And these were primarily the studies of Helmut Schmidt, who had done PK studies. And so I decided I would try to replicate these studies. And I found that I was able to get results which were similar to what Schmidt was talking about, which was shocking to me. And I continued to do experiments at Bell Labs for about 3 years until I convinced myself that whatever I'm looking at here does seem to be a real effect. And as soon as you make the internal switch that there's something interesting going on, well, then for any scientist would be hooked. And I was hooked by it because I felt that the miracle was happening sufficiently often to capture my attention. So since then, I've managed to now spend the majority of my professional career doing research on psychic phenomena in the laboratory. And I've paid a lot of attention to the kinds of criticisms that Michael and others have brought to look at the issues of independent replication, the size of the effects that are seen, and all of the usual objections, to make an assessment as to whether or not we're dealing with something which is real or not real.
Do you find, Dean, that science is beginning to back up now what we always thought were things that were in the metaphysical realm?
Well, I don't know about metaphysical, but certainly within a limited class of psychic effects, and I'm talking specifically about things like telepathy, about mind-matter interaction, precognition, and a few other things, that the tools of science have been brought to bear on these phenomena and a strong conclusion can be reached. And I believe the conclusion is that these phenomena do exist.
Let's talk a little bit with your experience with the Global Conscious Project, because that, though you're not directly handling it, you have looked into it. And I know people who've seen you at conferences talking about it. And it is truly something that I think is quite remarkable, but explain a little bit of it for us, Dean, and then we'll bring Michael in to get his reaction.
Okay. The Global Consciousness Project is essentially a field experiment. It's taking a mind-matter interaction phenomena that's been seen in the laboratory for about 50 years. It's a very small effect in which intention, human intention, seems to affect the distribution of random numbers. And so Roger Nelson was the first one to think of taking that basic laboratory experiment and bringing it into the real world to see whether it wasn't simply intention, but perhaps attention, focused human attention, that somehow changed the distribution of random events. And the idea, the underlying idea, is that if mind and matter are in fact connected in some way, as a hypothesis, then when mind becomes coherent or focused, then perhaps matter would become coherent or focused. Well, in matter, we use random numbers because the type of coherence that we're looking for is a form of statistical order, which can be detected very easily. So Roger began to do experiments with a random number generator in the vicinity of groups, like meditation groups. Mm-hmm. And shortly afterwards, I started to do that too, and we were getting pretty much the same result, that when a group was doing a highly focused event, that we would see order appear in randomness where it shouldn't be there.
Were they changing the outcome of the event, Dean, or just picking it up?
No, they weren't actually even aware of the fact that there were random generators going. The groups were typically involved in something like a meditation, mm-hmm, or watching some interesting event, something where you can infer that the group was being cohered mentally. And then we look at the same time in the random generators to see if order appears. And then as a control, you take the same device in the same place, either when there's no group present or when the group is doing something where you know that everyone's mind is scattered. And then you see how the random generator works. And under those conditions, it behaves like chance. So after some years of doing these experiments in groups, we got the idea to try to expand it to the size of the planet. So as of today, we have about 70 random number generators in different cities around the world. They're running 24 hours a day. And we keep track of large-scale news events, and we use those news events, like 9/11 and tsunami and so on, as a way of inferring that some percentage of the world mind is paying attention to the same thing.
And you see these spikes? I mean, is it obvious?
Well, sometimes they look like spikes, but more often it looks like a drift. There's a drift away from chance. And there's two ways that we do this. One is a pre-planned formal hypothesis. Because one of the criticisms of this is, well, you're looking for patterns and data.
Right.
And that is not the case, because if somebody says, well, look, there's an earthquake, we go in to the random generator data at the beginning of the earthquake, and we use a four-hour period, which is the standard way we do it. We use a standard analysis, and we either get a result or we don't. And when we apply that kind of analysis to the over 200 events or so that we have now, statistically, there's no question that the random generators are behaving in a less random way during large-scale events than they are during control periods.
Technically, these random number generators look like what, and then how do they work?
They look like a small silver box, about 2 inches, 2 inches by 2 inches by maybe a quarter of an inch, and they run through the serial port of a PC. The silver box is metal. So the box actually is like a Faraday cage. It shields the internal circuit from external electromagnetics. The source of the randomness, there are two types of generators that are used. Both can be ultimately traced down to quantum effects, quantum tunneling effects. And the noise that's created from this quantum tunneling is sampled and eventually turned into bits. So the devices are pushing out streams of random bits. That's basically all there is to it. And because the random bits, if collected in samples, will create a random walk, and we see how that random walk changes over time.
The more you have, the more accurate the readings, or do you need more?
What the additional number of generators allows us to do is to look at intercorrelations among the generators. You see, part of the hypothesis is that order is created somehow. We don't know how. But if it is created, the question arises as to, well, will it deviate from chance? The answer is yes. But how does one generator and another both behave? They should both be influenced by the same thing if there was really some common effect. So by having multiple generators, we're able to look at how 2 and 3 and 4 and up to 70 generators act in concert. So the metaphor I use sometimes in this is as though you had a bunch of buoys scattered across the ocean. And if you had a little bell that can tinkle on each one of these buoys, if you're able to hear all of them at the same time, most of the time you'd hear just this random roar, basically, this random tinkling of all these different bells, because the buoys are far apart from each other and are behaving more or less randomly. But if something really big hits the ocean, like a meteorite or a tsunami, suddenly you hear no longer random tinkling, but more like a chord, because all of the buoys will be pulled or pushed by a common source. And that's the kind of large-scale correlations that we look at then among all of these isolated random generators.
Somehow, Michael Shermer, I don't think you believe that this works.
Well, you wouldn't have me on here if I wasn't skeptical. A couple of thoughts. I think...
yeah, but I want you to agree with one of these guests.
I'm happy to agree with something if I think it's real. Like hypnosis, for example, but that's a subject for a different show. Okay, a couple thoughts. At the end of the last show, I was trying to address this issue of non-locality and quantum physics explaining this spooky action at a distance, if there is anything that needs to be explaining. The problem with it, with that model, as I see it, is that these quantum effects, these non-local action at a distance effects, are happening at the subatomic level, whereas our neurons in our brains are operating at the molecular level. These are, chemicals that are being released across these synaptic gaps between neurons. And those are about three orders of magnitude larger than these subatomic quantum effects. So I can't see how that can explain anything. So even if there is something to explain, we're still left, in my opinion, with absolutely no way to explain how it would happen. Then I think in terms of the one other point I wanted to make with the remote viewing, which is related to this, is that if it did work so well and the government spent $20 million on it over 20 years then and we were finding enemies of the state, why did they stop it? And so if this research really can work, why isn't, say, Microsoft using this or Wall Street to influence the flow of stock to go up rather than down, you know, something like
well,
this.
Well, fair question, Dean.
Well, let's see. I'll start first with the non-locality issue. It's quite true that if you imagine that the brain is working at the neuronal level, then quantum mechanics is way too small, essentially. And also the brain is too hot and too wet to sustain quantum coherence. But if you think about, well, how is the neuron working? What's making that work? And you start looking down into the depths of the neuron, you find that at the synaptic cleft, that the channels are so small that you actually are dealing with individual ions at the synaptic cleft. And at that point, at individual neurons, that is a quantum state. And so there are physicists like Henry Stapp who have created models which show that the brain can be thought of essentially as a disposed quantum system. Not at the neuronal level, but at the subneuronal level, because of the ion channels. And, of course, all of the action in the neurons is at the synaptic cleft, which is exactly where these ions are. So there's plenty of room within the brain for quantum effects. The fact that we haven't specifically found those effects yet is more a matter of our ability to detect such things rather than the theoretical possibility.
Wasn't there a poll in your magazine, Michael, on just how people believed in the existence of psychic phenomena?
That was in a different publication, but it had to do with how educated somebody was. And I mean, the intuitive notion is that people that believe weird things must not be as intelligent or as educated, which is absolutely not true. These things are orthogonal, as we say. They're not related to one another. In fact, I'm often surprised at the sorts of weird things that university professors and PhD scientists and so on believe. It's sort of independent of that. My quick answer to that, why smart people believe weird things, is because they're better at rationalizing beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons, which is to say emotional reasons or psychological needs or whatever.
And you, at least tonight, coincidentally enough, you are all selected, but you all have, you know, backgrounds in psychology.
Yeah, well, we are studying psychology in a way. I mean, these are psychological anomalies or interesting anomalies that are worth exploring, and we can try to get at it. I think this is one of the interesting questions in the history of science is, you know, how long do you pursue anomalies? What do you do with them? You know, for most mainstream scientists that are just sort of at the bench grinding away doing their whatever normal science, there's nothing particularly fringy or anomalistic like that happening. It does take somebody to you know, sort of go out and tackle these things, which is what, you know, we all do, I guess. But how long do you pursue it before you move on to new problems? It's like with Bigfoot and Loch Ness and so on. I say, you know, show me the body. We've been looking for 100 years. You know, when you find something, let me know, but let's go off and try something else. And I guess I've gotten to the point with ESP and Psi that, you know, unless something really spectacular happens, I think I'd rather focus my attention on some other problems, because we've been at it for over a century. And again, the results are always kind of tantalizingly not quite there and hard to replicate and subtle effects. And you got to have these random number generators or the ping pong balls over the eyes or, you know, sort of loosey-goosey psychic descriptions that make it really hard to quantify. It's all so difficult to get our, you know, minds around to really decide one way or the other, which is what we like in science is, you know, okay, let's run that experiment and have that definitive answer. And that's been frustratingly non-existent, in my opinion.
Have you ever had a psychic experience, Michael, or something intuitive?
I have, sure. And I either try to explain it with natural explanations that we know about, or I have a pretty high tolerance of ambiguity. I don't mind not knowing. It's okay. I mean, I've had deja vu experiences. I think I can explain them, but maybe not. But I'm okay just saying I don't know. Like with, we were talking about life after death earlier. I'm not worried about it. I don't have to have a definitive answer one way or the other. I'm okay just saying, you know, beats me. I don't know. We'll see when we get there. But in terms of, you know, genuine psychic experience, well, part of the problem is it depends on how you look at these things on these one-off events. You know, this happened or that happened at 3 a.m, or I thought about this person and the phone rang or whatever. If you believe that it's psychic power, that becomes a piece of data in support of your idea. And if you don't, then it becomes a piece of data of part of, you know, just out of how probabilities, the law of large numbers, you know, that sort of thing works. And
but of course, that's exactly why experiments are run, because then you know under what the controlled conditions are, and you can assign an actual probability as opposed to the anecdote where you didn't really never know.
Right.
I think that you're hand waving a little bit on the dozen or so usual skeptical reasons for not believing any of this. And one of the reasons I object to that kind of dismissal is because for each one of the things that you said, I can respond back. Of course, we don't have time to do this, but what I would do, and I have done in my books, is say, well, exactly what is the objection? Is it, let's take, for example, the issue about the polls. You sort of sidestep the issue of the more intelligent and educated people are, the more they believe in psychic phenomena.
Yeah, but they also believe other things. I mean, the intelligent design creationists, for example, these are really smart guys, but that doesn't make them right.
No, but certainly the direction is that if there are people out there who you can consider to be smarter than you, who believe in something and you don't believe it, well, then who's right?
Yeah, and so it's irrelevant.
No, it's completely relevant. Ultimately, imagine you're trying to explain quantum mechanics to a hamster. Well, the hamster is going to think you're crazy after a while because it's not part of their reality. But you might be right. Quantum mechanics is correct. It's just not something that they're able to understand.
Well, what a fast show. We'll be back with Dean Radin and Dr. Michael Shermer in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Well, we've got a great week of programs for you right here on Coast to Coast AM, so make sure you're part of it. And then don't forget, this weekend, Art Bell, Saturday and Sunday, Ian Punnett with the early edition, 6 p.m. Pacific time, with a whole cast of people here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dean Radin, our guest, of course, and Dr. Michael Shermer. Dean, God forbid, if there's another terrorist attack in the United States, would you expect under this Global Consciousness Project to see more things going on?
Probably, yes. Sure.
Can we detect things before they occur?
Well, there's some consideration that some kinds of events, we call them impulse events. These are typically unexpected things, unexpected big things like giant earthquakes and terrorist activity, that they show a deviation from chance that begins a couple of hours before the event unfolds. We've looked back in the data for earthquakes in particular, and there is some evidence that that is true in general for earthquakes, but only earthquakes that happen around large populations, and not earthquakes happening, for example, where there are no people. So it suggests that not only is there a precursor, but it's related in some way to people.
Now, and why, Michael, can't you believe that it's possible that people have this ability, innate ability?
That particular claim sounds really ridiculous, that somehow people sense the earthquake is coming, or they precognitively predict it.
Well, animals sense it. You agree with that?
And then they influence random number generators as a sign. I don't know. This really sounds absurd. Sorry. It just does.
Well, but the absurdity for you is because you can't think of a way to explain it.
No, it's not even that. It's just, it sounds ridiculous.
No, but why? I mean, tell me exactly why.
I mean, how about something like, well, like I said with the previous guest, tell us where Osama bin Laden is. If you guys can really do this stuff, you know, do something useful, not after the fact, post hoc reasoning on the data graphs and, ooh, look, something happened here after it happened. How about giving us something useful?
No, but as I said, the analyses that we use are pre-planned hypotheses. We're not looking for interesting patterns in data. And as far as looking for a specific person, the nature of the phenomena is not robust enough to be able to do something on demand like that.
Now, an interesting piece of research is on the wisdom of crowds and how the stock market becomes a type of phenomenon. Now, you should be able to do something with that. In other words, like millions of people trade, say Microsoft or Google or whatever,
sure,
every day, you know, and particularly with a stock like Google, it goes up 10, 20, 30 bucks a day, then it goes down 50 bucks and it goes up 20 bucks.
Well,
huge effect.
It sells at like 400 or something like that.
What's that?
It sells like at 400 or something.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, your little random number generator should be going crazy. And then you should be able to turn that into something useful, like, okay, it looks like tomorrow for sure. Or if you say these things happen a couple hours ahead of time, well, then you should be able to turn that into something like, well, okay, the stock's going to start crashing now or going up, so let's make our trades now and that sort of thing.
Well, we've looked at different kinds of categories of events. Things like natural disasters actually do not show much of a big event. Things that involve large-scale celebrations, funerals, things that seem to involve strong emotion do have a larger effect. In the case of the stock market, it's not so clear. I mean, yes, there are some people who are trading, but how many people are actually paying close attention at any given time to the stock market?
Well, how many do you need?
Well, we don't know. this is why it's an empirical question.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair question. How many do you need? What's the Maharishi? It's the square root of 1% of the world's population. Well, you know, I don't know where you got that number, but you know, at least it's a number.
Right.
You know, so that's an issue, I think. And again, it's just one of these things that's hard to sink your teeth into. I'd like to see, you know, more replicated results, experiments, and it's not just a handful of us skeptics, me and Randy and Richard Wiseman and whoever. You know, 99% of scientists don't buy any of this stuff. They don't even bother with it.
I don't agree with that at all.
And
no, I really don't agree with that. I mean, I would guess that probably 30% of scientists just dismiss it or they don't pay any attention to it. But I'm also guessing that about 70% pay attention to it. And the reason is that after writing The Conscious Universe in 97, I have a new book about to come out also, I was contacted by hundreds of scientists, and they're the tip of the iceberg. And I know that because whenever I go to give a talk in a technical environment, it's always standing room only. And I ask the audience, well, how come all you scientists are here? And the answer is that they're interested. They may not believe it 100%, but they're interested. So I think actually it's a small minority of scientists who dismiss it outright. In terms of replication, I've spent a fair amount of my time looking in some detail at whether or not the effects in these experiments replicate. I wouldn't at this point hang my hat on the Global Consciousness Project. It's too new. It's difficult to replicate because we only have one network out there. But in terms of things like the Gonsfeld experiment, the telepathy experiment, random number generator studies, precognition studies, and so on, these have been replicated dozens to hundreds of times by independent labs.
I know you say that, but, you know, like the big one is the BEM and the Daryl BEM experiment in 94. And my God, if this was true, I mean, labs all over the world should be just rushing out to do this. And like with the cold fusion, I mean, okay, this could change the world. Let's go out and find out right now before that we start issuing patents and go on the stock market with it. Within months, the whole thing, you know, blew up.
But we may get there one day, Michael.
Well, and not only that, in this case, it wasn't the case that people rushed out and did this experiment and found that it failed. In fact, there was no rush at all. And the reason
experiment?
I'm talking about the Gonsfeld telepathy experiment.
Oh, yeah, I know. Right.
The reason there was no rush of people to do the experiment has much more to do with how scientists are driven by theory than they are being interested in empirically testing things. That's the reason why.
Well,
I hope you would agree that one of the reasons behind the skepticism is that it's very difficult to imagine how these things could work.
Nevertheless, with quantum mechanics, despite the fact that it's hard to understand and really weird, it's true and everybody accepts it because the experiments are so, there's so many of them. The data is so overwhelming, you know, to the sixth place after the decimal point kind of accuracy. Well, you know, slam dunk, it's done. Whether you believe it or not, it's true. And no matter how weird it seems, it's true anyway. Okay, and we all, skeptics don't scoff at that. So that's the difference, that they have the data, incredible data, whereas you don't.
Well, but you're also equating a physics experiment against a psychological experiment. And as you're probably well aware, there are very few psychological experiments that will give you an arbitrary level of probability. So, I mean, here we're even dealing with something which is worse, which is it's not really just psychology, and it's not really just physics. The hypothesis is that there's a connection between psychology and physics, in which case you're dealing with a hyper-complex system, in which case, when you look at the meta-analyses, it becomes amazing that actually overall you do get very strong effects.
And overall, Dean, when we talk about psychic phenomena, in your opinion, what are we really talking about then?
You mean in terms of what is the evidence like?
Well, there's just the whole overall view. I mean, when you say psychic phenomena, it's so broad. Let's hone it in on something specific that you have found in your career to truly be mind-boggling.
And in general, the phenomena can be thought of as anomalies of information transfer between people. That's typically the strongest kind of phenomena that is replicated. It manifests as telepathy, if you look at it that way, or as precognition or clairvoyance or remote viewing. So there are different ways of looking at the same form of phenomena, which is information transfer, in an anomalous way that doesn't seem to involve the ordinary senses. That, I think, is very well established experimentally. For direct mind-matter interaction, there's a class that involves random number generators. There's another class that involves human intention on distant physiology, distant people's physiology, and a smaller class of studies looking at distant intention effects on biology in terms of bacteria and that sort of thing. So within a few of these restricted classes of phenomena, the sort of things that people talk about in their daily lives, there from the laboratory evidence, I would say that the evidence is extremely good overall. We still don't have any single experiment which anybody can do and get a significant result every time. But on composite, some of the experiments that have been developed are extremely strong.
And do people tend to get better the more they either practice or they do whatever they have to do?
So far, there's no evidence that training seems to make a big difference.
Hmm.
But there is evidence that selecting people based on things like, are they open-minded about the phenomena? That makes a difference. Are they highly motivated to have an outcome occur? The answer is yes, that makes a difference. There are some kinds of personality effects like this and also motivational factors that do modulate the effects. But training specifically, there haven't been enough studies to look at whether training really works or not.
And Michael, in your, we've talked to you about mediums, remote viewing, general psychic phenomena. You don't believe any of it.
Yeah, well, I'm skeptical. There's all sorts of things I believe in. Here's one that I did a big switcheroo on recently was the notion of intuition. There's now really good experimental evidence showing that that we can do what's called thin slicing. That is, we can pick up information very quickly, very subtly, maybe not even consciously aware of gathering information about particularly other people and particularly relationships with other people. We appear to be really quite good at that. For example, this experiment done with students doing evaluations of their professors after a whole semester and then showing another group of subjects just like a 30-minute video clip of the professor, and they give essentially the exact same evaluation, and then
right.
showing just like a 1-minute clip with no sound.
And you get the same thing.
Yeah. So that's something that it appears that I would have been completely skeptical about before I was skeptical about. Intuition is just like the bane of skeptics. And, well, it's true. Okay, fine. I don't have any problems with that. The data is there. And there's a mechanism. It still fits within the natural worldview of how things work. We're still picking up the information. Even if you're not conscious of it, there's still a perfectly good theory of consciousness, Dan Dennett's theory of consciousness, that, the vast majority of things that are happening in our brain and the information coming in, we're not even aware of.
Well, if you believe this, why don't you believe all of it then?
Well, because for two reasons. One, it requires some other kind of natural phenomenon that we don't have an understanding of yet.
Which is a theoretical argument.
Yeah, so there's the theory, and then, I'm not convinced that the data is all that good. I think there are some methodological flaws. I would like more replication. I wish it was, more quantifiable in a more distinct way, dramatic way, instead of these subtle things like the random number generators. I find that just sort of a weird thing. So it lacks, in my opinion, it lacks both the data and the theory. Which are not as strong, I think, as in this other example. So it's not that I won't change my mind. It's just that I'm not there yet.
Dean, you've written, of course, The Conscious Universe, which was very well done. You've got another one coming out, don't you?
Right. The new book is Entangled Minds.
What's that about?
It's basically asking the question of, given that we know we live in a non-local universe, as Russell Targ said, what if the brain actually was a quantum object? And in fact, we know it is, but it seems to act in a classical way, but ultimately it is a quantum object. What if that quantum object actually interacts with other quantum objects? In other words, it's as though you're looking at entangled photons, except that you can get inside the photon and make decisions. They're like little intelligent
mm-hmm.
photons. Would you find entanglements between minds and between minds and bodies and that sort of thing? And I say, well, if that were true, then what you might expect to find are things like occasionally people would know what somebody else is thinking, or occasionally your intention might impinge on somebody else's body and so on.
It's almost like having X-ray eyes.
Well, more that the types of effects you would expect if, in fact, we lived in a quantum entangled mind world are exactly what people have called psychic, in which case, taking that as a starting point, I go through about 3,000 experiments in different classes to show what can we believe based on the experimental evidence.
3,000 experiments, that's a lot of data.
Well, it's surveying the past century worth of data in different classes of experiments. And the bottom line is that if you start with the hypothesis that we appear to be entangled, and then you look at the evidence in human behavior, there's very strong evidence that, in fact, we are entangled. Now, whether it's quantum entanglement or not is another issue. So for the physicists, I say, well, let's use this as a metaphor. And for everyone other than physicists, I say, well, maybe it really is quantum entanglement.
Michael, what would you have said about Edgar Cayce had he been around during your day?
Edgar Cayce, okay. well, gosh, I mean, the guy made, 40,000 readings or something. He's bound to be right about some of those things. But back to this other thing, I just wanted to say something about the quantum business. This is a difficult subject. Few people actually really understand it. So I went to Murray Gell-Mann at Caltech, who won the Nobel Prize for his research on quantum effects and discovery of quarks and so on. And I asked him about this, and he says, this is utter rubbish that these quantum effects all wash out at the macro level, that at that molecular size of where the brain is operating.
But Michael, you just said
those would all wash out. I mean, the moon is there whether you look at it or not. The moon is not like a subatomic particle that has to be observed. And the brain is the same thing. It's too big.
But Michael, you just said that we shouldn't pay attention to what intelligent people say because they could be wrong. So why should we believe Murray Gell-Mann?
Yeah, that's a non sequitur. I mean,
No. That's,
you wanted to know what, you said that maybe I don't understand quantum mechanics. All right, so I asked somebody who does, and he says that's nonsense.
But why do we take his word for it?
Well, you don't have to. I already gave you the explanation for it. It's three orders of magnitude too big.
So we can go to another Nobel laureate.
Warm and mushy and wet.
Let's go to Brian Josephson, who was also a Nobel laureate.
There's no vacuum. Where's the vacuum in the brain for these things to happen in?
I mean, it
doesn't make sense that the brain is how could you write a book on the quantum mechanical brain? It isn't quantum mechanical. So what else is there to say?
I already said that the ions in the synaptic clefts are quantum mechanical.
How?
Because of the size. They're at the nanoscale. And by the way, who said you needed a vacuum in order to have quantum effects? That's ridiculous. And the whole point of pointing to authority for saying, well, this person said this and that said that, for every Nobel laureate you name, I can name another Nobel laureate who gives completely the opposite result. So at this point, I think I would agree with you that nobody knows what the actual answer is, but there's plenty of evidence on both sides.
I'm back to not really need anything there's nothing that actually needs explaining. I mean, there's anomalies in some research, I guess, and weird stories of things that go bump in the night in people's lives, but I'm just not convinced by the research.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this: of the three different areas that you battled tonight, that being remote viewing, mediums, and just pure psychic phenomena, is there any one of those three that you think is possible?
No, probably not. I would say that the likeliest thing is that, back to this intuition business, that people are a lot more connected through just the normal senses than we're even remotely aware of. And so there's a lot going on subconsciously. And I think where the great mysteries are that should be that we should really be focusing on is, what is consciousness? Where is the self located? Is there a self module? There's no theory of the neural correlates of consciousness yet. There's some interesting research by Christoph Koch at Caltech,
for example.
But we have a long ways to go before we understand consciousness. So why jump into things like the super consciousness sort of concepts before we even understand what consciousness is?
Well, two go in and one comes out. Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Michael Shermer, as well. And thank you, Russell Targ, and everyone else, Dr. Gary Schwartz, for participating in this. We'll do this again with other guests and other skeptics, if I can find other skeptics. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Rob Ismail, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, you make up your own mind of the two who went in, and you figure out who came out. Be safe, everyone.